असतो मा सद्गमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्युर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ शांति शांति शांतिः ॐ लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल लीड अस फ्रॉम डार्कनेस अनटू लाइट लीड अस फ्रॉम डेथ टू इमॉर्टैलिटी ॐ पीस 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 Namaste and welcome. Another brilliant day here in Manhattan. Today the subject is Purnam. It's a Sanskrit word which means the whole, the full, infinite, limitless. This actually forms a pair with last Sunday's talk, which was titled Shunyam, which means the void or emptiness. So emptiness and fullness. In fact, just a little correction for last Sunday's talk. I mentioned a particular book, Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness, and I said somebody who had recommended it to me, but it turns out somebody else had recommended, and he wrote, no, it was me. I recommended it to you. So it was. Jackson Peterson, who was a Tibetan Buddhist master and teacher in this country and abroad also, many places abroad. So we are very grateful to him because that book really put a lot of things in place for me. Purnam, why I selected this as, this is sort of, for me, this is a word which encompasses the vision of Vedanta in its entirety and its depth. For me, it is particularly evocative because when I was growing up, a little boy in a city called Bhubaneswar on the eastern coast of India, we have a very beautiful Ramakrishna Mission ashram there, which was founded in all the way back in 1918 by Swami Brahmananda, the first president of the Ramakrishna order, whom Sri Ramakrishna considered his spiritual son. Beautiful ashram and very, very deep spiritual vibrations there. Now, as a little kid, one of the memories of the ashram that I have is going upstairs to the shrine. The shrine was on the roof, it still is. But in the old shrine, when you go up there, this is about 40 years ago. First, you enter through a room you used to in those days. And that room was a bare little room, very sparse, and I can still feel the cool floor on my bare feet, and the sunlight streaming through the open windows. There's a very beautiful garden outside, and very silent, except for sometimes chirping of birds. And there was just this one mantra written on a wooden board hung up on the wall. That's all. There was nothing else in that room as far as I remember. And that mantra said, in Sanskrit, the famous Shanti mantra from the Upanishads, Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Which means, Om, that is the infinite Brahman. That means, I'll explain that. So that is the infinite Brahman. This manifested universe is also Purnam. Is that infinite Brahman? Is Brahman? And from that Purnam, this Purnam has come. From that fullness, this fullness has arisen. Purnat Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnam Adaya. In this manifested universe, if you recognize the infinite here, then Purnam Eva Vashishyate, the infinity alone remains, or the fullness alone remains. So if you put it together, what does it say? It says, that is the full. This universe is also the full. And this fullness has come from that fullness. And in this, if you recognize the infinity, then that fullness or that infinity alone remains. Om, peace, peace, peace. Now, I don't know how much I understood of that. I was a little kid. I knew some Sanskrit because we were studying it in school, so I was able to read it. But it was very evocative for me. I don't know if it's some kind of memories of past life or something, but I always was fascinated. I remember before going to the shrine, I would stop and stare and just soak in the sunlight and the stillness in that room and that mantra on the wall. That's why it's always remained my favorite, peace chant, Shanti Mantra. Today, I want to go a little bit into it. It's the deepest truth about Vedanta, about Hinduism. And I think it's really great to reflect upon it a little bit. Let's go into this, in the profound depths of this mantra a little bit before we go ahead. Purnamadaha Purnamidam. The Sanskrit words adha idam. Adha means that. Something that is not perceptible. You don't see it, hear it, smell it, taste it, touch it. You can't comprehend it with your intellect. You don't have any information about it. It's something that you take on belief. You know, for example, God. God is in heaven. I don't see God. I don't understand it quite not too well. It's beyond my perception. It's beyond creation. That. In Sanskrit, there's a word for it. Paroksha. Paroksha means beyond the range of our senses. It's suprasensible. So that is full or infinity. That which is paroksha, beyond our range of our senses, which we take on belief. Maybe our religion has told us about it. Maybe we sort of believe in it, some kind of transcendent reality. And then it says, Purnamidam. This one, which we perceive right now, this world. This also is full. This is also full. Now, concentrate on the words idam and adha. Idam means this perceptible universe, which we are experiencing all the time. Adha means that transcendent, which we don't experience, and we sort of either believe in it or don't believe it. In any case, even if you believe in it, you take it on faith. And now see what the mantra is doing. It's so subversive. It just says both. That which is transcendent and that which is right now here empirically perceived and which you're experiencing all the time, they're the same thing. And by using the word Purnam, that's Purnam. This is Purnam. It's exactly the same thing. What has been done here is Paroksha and this Pratyaksha. Pratyaksha means direct. These two words are brought together and both are called Purnam. By that, what is done is, there's a Sanskrit word, badhita, negated. The remoteness and the immediate perceptibility, both of them are negated by showing that it's one reality. Go a little further. If that sounds cryptic and difficult, it'll become easier. But it is a very profound subject. If you go a little further, the next part of the mantra says, Purnat Purnam Udachyate. From that fullness, this fullness has arisen. If you want to put it in the language of theistic religion, God created the world. That's what is being said. God created the world. God created the world. From that fullness, this fullness has arisen. In the Sanskrit grammar of it, Purnat, that's the fifth case ending. From that, fifth case. Always from that means cause. A cause is being pointed out. And this is the effect. That is the creator. This is the created. And again, the mantra does something subversive. It says, that and this, that cause and this effect are both Purnam. They are not both. They are the same Purnam. By saying that, what has been done? Causality is negated. From that, this has been created. The mantra is saying, no, nothing has been created. That alone exists. And we are experiencing it as this. But this Purnam, this limitless, this whole, that alone exists. There is no difference between cause and effect. See, this is very profound. Because in traditional theistic religion, dualistic religion, what is said? God is the cause, the creator. And this universe is the created. dualistic in the sense of two different realities. So the cause is real. A dualistic religion will say cause is real. There are dualistic schools of Vedanta which will say the cause, God, is real, and this manifested universe is also real. Two realities. And they're separate. The two realities. God has created a separate universe. It's not that they are the same. The non-dualist, the Advaitin, will ask here a question, is that, see, if that is real, nobody doubts that the creator, God, Brahman, is real. Neither the dualist nor the non-dualist doubts. And both agree. There is some cause, Brahman, which is real. Some reality, Brahman. It's real. Now, the non-dualist asks this question to the dualist. If that is real, and something has come from that, something other than that has come. If something is other than reality, what happens to it? It becomes unreal. It becomes false. In fact, when, my dear dualist, when you claim that the world is a separate reality created by a creator God, it's equivalent to claiming the world is false. Because it's other than the real God, which I and you, both of us, agree. Whereas what the Advaitin says is that that Purnam and this Purnam, the cause Purnam and the effect Purnam, they're both one and the same. There is no cause and effect. This is the deepest conclusion which you find in texts like the Mandukya Karika, for example, negation of causality. There is apparent causality, and there is something which appears as this because they look different, they are experienced differently. It's like the gold made into the ornaments, the clay made into the pot. Now you would say, clay has produced a pot. If you say, produced a pot, is there a pot apart from the clay? If you look at the pot, it's clay and clay throughout. If you look at the golden ornament, it's gold and gold throughout. And the claim of this mantra is that if you examine this world, which appears to be a world of duality, of diversity, of continuous change, of ups and downs, of pleasure and pain, of life and death, if you actually examine, if we have eyes to see, we will see that absolute truth alone exists here. Satchidananda alone exists here. See, what I'm saying is this. I remember asking this great Swami, who passed away several years ago, Swami Nirmuktanandaji. He was a disciple of Swami Shivananda. I believe he was a spiritually very advanced soul. Many of us did believe. So once I asked him that he was sitting, if you have gone to Belur Math, the main monastery there on the bank of the Ganga, you've seen the temple of the Holy Mother, Ma Sharada. So you're sitting there and facing towards the temple of Swami Vivekananda. He was sitting there and he was at that time in his late 90s. So this Swami, I bowed down to him and I asked this question. So how does the enlightened one look upon this, you know, this world? Is it that there is Brahman and, you know, there existence, consciousness, bliss, and this world is like a kind of a shadow, you know? And then he thought for a moment and he said, no, why should that be? There is only one. This idea that there is a reality and there is a falsity, that there is a falsity, this is still dualistic thinking. This comes from an analysis, you know? Here in this world of appearances, I am analyzing and finding out the reality, and so this world remains as an appearance. Reality and appearance. But they are not two. What he told me, why should that be? There is only one. And of course, I had to push. So I asked him, all right, I didn't quite get what he was saying. All right, but is that how you are seeing this? I was trying to find out, is he going to confirm that he's enlightened? Is that how you are seeing the world right now? Are you seeing this display right now as one divine reality? And he replied with another story. He said, there's another very great monk, Swami Buddhananda, and Swami Jagadananda, disciple of the Holy Mother. Jagadananda was regarded as an enlightened person in his own time. This was in the 1950s, probably. So one day, this Swami Buddhananda, who was in charge of a Ramakrishna mission in Delhi, he asked Swami Jagadananda, apparently, well, sir, people say you're enlightened. Are you enlightened? And the Swami replied, if I say yes, will you believe me? I immediately understood what the Swami was trying to tell me. And I bowed down to him and said, yes, sir, I've understood, Swami. So this is a question about the... So if you're saying... are you trying to say that this itself is Brahman, what we are experiencing? It doesn't look like it. There is this question about the reality of the world and the falsity of the world. There are schools of Vedanta which say the world is real. There are schools of Vedanta, like Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta, which we're speaking about, which say the world is false. And there's a big quarrel about it. Is the world real or false? Is it a reality in itself or is it an appearance? Really speaking, that question is misguided. Sri Ramakrishna was asked once that... is the world false? Like Advaita Vedanta would have it would say. Sri Ramakrishna said, why should the world be false? That is a step in Vedantic inquiry. In Bengali he said, bichare katha. In the step in Vedantic inquiry. Now what is, it's a very nuanced reply. He did not say the world is not false, it's real. He didn't say that. He didn't say, of course the world is false. He said, no. When you say the world is false, he knows what's in the mind of the person who's asking. The person is asking from an Advaitic perspective, non-dual perspective. See, that's a step in non-dual inquiry. Vicharer katha, in Bengali, he said. But that's not remarkable also. Sri Ramakrishna's observation, that's a vicharer katha, it's not remarkable because Advaita itself, Advaitic texts like the Panchadashi, a classic of post-Shankara Advaita, they also say, the world is false. I'll tell you exactly what they say. Vidyaranya Swami, the author of the text Panchadashi, he says, what is the status of the world? Is it real or is it false? And who is saying this? A follower of Adi Shankaracharya, committed non-dualist, the author of the non-dual classic Panchadashi. He says that this world, he says, to the ordinary man in the street, you know, he says, vastavi, it's absolutely real. It can't be ignored. It's real. Vastavi means vastu, real. To the philosopher, to the inquirer, he says it is anirvachaniya. It cannot be classified as real ultimately or as unreal. That is the definition of falsity. Something that appears to us, like the rope, like the snake in the rope. It appears to us, like the water in the mirage. It appears to us, but it's not real in itself. There's no real water in the mirage. There's no real snake when it's actually a rope. So something that appears but does not exist. You can't deny that it appeared to you. For a moment you thought it was something else. So that's called falsity. It's like a lie. Somebody tells a lie. It's not the truth. But it's not nothing either. It didn't keep quiet. See, there are three things. Telling the truth and keeping quiet and telling a lie. So when somebody tells a lie, the person did say something. It's not nothing, but it's not the truth. Similarly, falsity is when we experience the reality as something other than what it is. So we experience the rope as a snake. It's not, you're not experiencing a rope as a rope. You're experiencing the desert, not as a desert, but as an oasis full of water. That's a mirage. So Panchadashi, the author of Panchadashi, Vidyaranya Swami says, when you inquire with logic, when you reason, you will come to this conclusion that the world is an appearance. It's not nothing, but it's not the ultimate truth. You can't say it's nothing because it appears to you. You experience it all the time. But you can't say it's the ultimate truth, which is pure consciousness, existence, whatever you call it. And then he goes on to say, this author of Panchadashi, to the enlightened one, so three views, the worldly man's view, the philosopher's view, and the enlightened one's view. To the enlightened one, he says, there is no world, there's Brahman alone. There's only one non-dual reality. Just like that Swami told me. Why should it be two? It's only one. Because I had asked that Swami, is it that you see, the enlightened one sees absolute reality, existence, consciousness, bliss, and this world like a shadow sort of hanging around, you know? And he said, no, it's not like that. It's one. And the one is Brahman or that absolute reality. So see, three answers to the question, is the world real? To the man on the street, yes, the world is real. Vastavi, it's true. To the person in a dream, whatever he's experiencing in the dream doesn't know it's a dream. It's real. It's practically, it's what is being experienced. But when you inquire into it, it's neither real nor non-existing. it's what is called false. And for the fully enlightened one, it's Brahman. Brahman alone exists. There's no separate reality called the world. And that's what exactly Sri Ramakrishna said. When Sri Ramakrishna was asked, is this world false? He said, why should it be false? That falsity of the world is a stage in inquiry, that philosophical inquiry when you do vichara. You come to this conclusion, the world cannot be determined as absolutely real or as completely unreal. So what is being said here is, Purnat Purnam Udachyate, if you literally translate, it means from the full, this fullness has come. But if you look a little deeper, that is being called, the cause is being called Purnam, and the effect is also being called Purnam, effectively denying that there is any cause and effect, that really nothing has happened. It seems to have happened that way, that the world seems to have appeared before you. Something has been produced, but actually it is the same reality. Purnam. In which case, what is being said here? What's being said here is, whatever we are experiencing, wherever we are, worldly, spiritual, in whatever sense, whichever religion we belong to, whatever we are experiencing, the dramatic claim is, you are experiencing nothing but God. Swami Vivekananda said, never approach anything except as God. Because that's the fact. The fact is that there's only one non-dual reality. If Advaita Vedanta is true, in that case, whatever is real must be that one reality, because it's non-dual, no second reality. If there are multiple realities, maybe, right, I'm experiencing a reality called a world, and there is some other reality called God, heaven, something else. But if it is non-dual, Advaita, then whatever we are experiencing must be that non-dual reality. What, in other words, whatever we are experiencing in the language of religion must be God. It's a very, why it is profound, it's a very capacious idea of the ultimate reality. What do I mean by that is, what this Purnamada Purnamidam is saying is, if it is formless and it cannot be with form, it's an incomplete God. If it is with form and you deny that it can ever be formless, it's an incomplete God. If you say it is with form, but it only has to be, God has to be a male form, it's an incomplete God. Always Shiva goes with Shakti. And Shakti, you cannot say it is only Shakti. There's always Shiva in the background. If it's only female, then it's an incomplete God. If it's only to be worshipped in a form which is with a human form, it's an incomplete God. That's why in Sanatana Dharma, in Hinduism, you have God being worshipped as a fish, the Matsya Avatara, as the tortoise, the Kurma Avatara, as the man lion in the human form, in the male form, in the female form, in the male and female form together, Ardhanarishvara, and with no form, formless. But the idea always is, if you say it is only formless, then it's an incomplete God. Then comes the Muslim or the Christian and says, well, God is formless, and these Hindus have got it wrong. Smash these images and destroy the temples. No, it's an incomplete idea of God, you've got. It leads to fanaticism, it leads to hatred, it leads to violence. It is what is called in Vedanta, in yoga also, raga dvesha. Likes and dislikes. Strong likes and dislikes. See, what is the problem with strong likes and dislikes? Practically, it's all right. People can have preferences. We'll automatically have preferences. However, deep within, we should not hold on to these preferences as ultimately true. Because if it is a non-dual reality, then whatever we are experiencing, whether we prefer it, whether we don't prefer it, whether we love it or whether we hate it, it must be the same reality. The same Brahman in our friends and in what we consider to be our enemies. People like us and in what we see as people different from us. In human beings and in non-human beings. In living beings and in non-living things. It must be the same background reality somewhere. Otherwise, non-duality cannot be true. when we have this idea of non-duality, it translates into Purnam. And that is what you see, if you look at the enormous breadth and richness of the Sanatana Dharma of Hinduism. The non-dualistic schools, dualistic schools, Vishishtadvaita, Dvaita, all the different schools. How can it be such extraordinary variety can happily coexist with each other? Even a lot of Hindus don't understand this. So there have been occasionally, reform schools. No. We must not worship images. And therefore, let's have a reformed Hinduism without image worship. And there were reform movements always. That's all right. Hinduism is fine with that too. Sri Ramakrishna came up as a bulwark against this silliness. He comes and quite unapologetically, he goes and worships an image. And the image of Kali, Bhavatarini Kali, in Dakshineshwar. And reaches enlightenment, not just enlightenment. The range and breadth of his spiritual experiences is unparalleled in the history of spirituality. Show me one other instance of such extraordinary samadhis, of such extraordinary mystical experiences, of such extraordinarily universal teachings. No, you cannot find another example like that. That's why Vivekananda said, if image worship can produce one like Ramakrishna, worship 1,000 images, I say. So Purnam, a capacious idea of the divine. If the divine is worshipped as Shiva, the male form, as Parvati or Durga, Kali and Lakshmi in the female form, as Ganesha. If your god cannot be an elephant-headed god, it's an incomplete god. But if your god is only the elephant-headed god, it's also an incomplete god. So where does this extraordinarily capacious idea of divinity come from? From Purnam. It includes all of it. Last time we did Buddhism, and you can say this sounds very different from it. That sounds very minimal. Extraordinarily logical and minimal. Philosophically austere. This sounds very maximal. Inclusive of anything and everything. What this does is, it frees us from raga dvesha, from from thinking that this alone must be right and that cannot be right. It frees us from fanaticism. It frees us from thinking that only Sri Ramakrishna, one thing he did not like at all, he would say again and again, in Bengali he said, motuar buddhi, dogmatic attitude. He said, never set a limit to what God can be. Never set a limit to the infinitude of that ultimate reality. That comes from this Purnam. The fullness of what is experienced here and there. In the cause and in the effect. It's the same reality. All right, I still haven't started. Now I'm going to... If you ask those great... philosophers, Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, if you gave them this Purnam idea, what would they say? They would smile tolerantly and would say, that's cute, but it doesn't stand to reason. You must establish it on the basis of reason and experience. So that's what Advaita Vedanta sets out to do. This vision was there. In the Vedas itself, this vision was there of this Purnam. This Purnamada, Purnamidam comes from the Vedas. But how do you... make it a logical philosophy, a logical worldview or God view, whatever you call it. And how do you experience it, make it part of your living, your lived life? So here goes. Advaita Vedanta, I'll take the Advaitic philosophy, which establishes this Purnam. It says, the unique thing about Advaita Vedanta is that it's not a philosophy or spiritual path which says that there's something else to be attained. What you get in Advaita Vedanta is what you have always had. Something, and what you remove in Advaita Vedanta is something that was never there. Now, I always say it sounds like a con job. There was this snake oil salesman in the Wild West, Wild West, and he was arrested and brought before the magistrate by the sheriff on charges of offering cures to non-existent diseases and, real cures to imaginary diseases and imaginary cures to real diseases. So Advaita Vedanta sounds like that. When it says, what will you get after all of this? You will get what you always had. And what will you remove? What will you get rid of? What will you improve after all of this? Said, what was never there. That's what you're going to get rid of. In Sanskrit, this is called praptasya prapti nivrittasya nivritti. But they mean it, praptasya prapti means attaining what is already attained. Nivrittasya nivritti means removing, negating, curing, something that was never there. But what does it mean then? It is because of our ignorance, what is already attained, what was always there, seems to be not there. Advaita Vedanta says, you are Brahman. You are not this body, not this mind. You are limitless existence, consciousness, bliss. And you are that right now, whether you know it or not. Whether you believe it or not. Whether you think you're experiencing it or not. Advaita Vedanta says, it's right there. It's already attained. Just because of ignorance, it feels like, no, I don't know this. I don't experience this. I don't see this. I've told you sometimes about this class I used to attend of Ashtavakra Samhita from a great teacher in the Himalayas, in Gangotri. And sometimes, teaching us this doctrine, this teaching, he would look at us and he would say, oh monks, whether you believe it or not, whether you experience it or not, the truth is, you are Rama. Tum jano ya na jano, mano ya na mano, tum hi Ram. Your Rama means you're God, you're one with God. And what does it remove? Samsara. I am here in spiritual life because I am suffering. Like the Buddha said, there is suffering. So the first noble truth, and that has to be removed. I am suffering. I am going through birth. I'm afraid of birth and death, this cycle of birth and death. I'm terribly afraid of death. I'm afraid of old age and sickness. I'm afraid of financial ruin. And I'm suffering from the miserable behavior of others, or from generally the suffering of humanity and other living beings in this world. There's so much suffering here. I'm suffering, and spirituality promises to take me beyond suffering. Every religious path gives you a solution. In this way, you will go beyond suffering. You know, in samadhi or by going to heaven or something like that. The Advaitic path tells you that yes, this suffering actually, what you're thinking, it's always removed. You are beyond suffering. It's because of ignorance that you think that you're in suffering. All right, so this sounds very crazy. It sounds cool. I think Americans will love it. It sounds kind of counterintuitive. But how do we make sense of it? How do we make sense of the fact that right here, right now, I am that absolute truth, and I am beyond suffering, and so are we all. So Advaita Vedanta starts with experience. Not extraordinary experience, not mystical experience. See, the trick there is that someone might promise, all of this can be experienced, you don't have to believe it. But how do you experience it? Well, you put in the hard work of 40 years of meditation, and then maybe you'll experience it. If you don't, better luck next life. That is no good. Advaita Vedanta says what we are talking about is right now. It is being experienced now, but you don't recognize it. You know what it's like? If Jim is here, and I don't know who Jim is, and I'm looking at him, and somebody introduces, that's Jim. I say, oh, I see. Now I get it. That's Jim. Did I see somebody new? No. I was already looking at him. But I just recognized that this is Jim. Advaita Vedanta is like that. It brings us to see what is already there, but we never saw it earlier. The beautiful story of the washerman's diamond. The washerman found a diamond, but he didn't know what the diamond was. He just thought it's a rock. It's an odd-looking rock. And in India, you know, washermen, they will take your laundry out to the riverbank and they will slam it on the rocks. And they'll wash it. They'll get it clean, but you'll be horrified at what they do to the fabric. And then they'll scrub it clean, and they use that rock. So he used to use this diamond to scrub dirty clothes. And he didn't know this was, he had got something that could remove all his poverty. But he was curious. This rock is different from all other rocks. So let me ask my friend, the vegetable seller. And the vegetable seller was a little more thoughtful than the washerman, and he said, "Well, you know, this rock, it's pretty, so I'll give you and a bag of brinjals for it." The washerman did not sell it. He took it to somebody else who knew a little more. Finally, he took it to a diamond merchant. And the diamond merchant said, "This is a magnificent diamond. I'll give you millions of rupees for it." And so all the washerman's needs were removed. His poverty was gone forever. Now, that's a parable. The parable points to the fact that we already have the rock. But like the washerman, we don't know that it's a diamond. And Advaita Vedanta is like the diamond merchant who wants to introduce us to it so that all our problems are solved immediately. So what is this rock which we all have already, right now? It is experience. In Sanskrit, anubhava. What experience? All experience. Any experience. All right, right now I'm going to begin introducing us to the rock. So follow closely. Experience, when we look at our experience, which experience? All experience. Notice one thing about experience. All experience has this structure. In every experience you find, I am the subject and this is the object. Subject and object. Look around, right now, all the time. And right now, I am the subject. Take it in a very naive way. Don't be too non-dualistic and just in a very straightforward way. Here I am. I am the subject. And here is the object, the objective universe. I can see people, I can see chairs and the hall, I can see the road and the trees outside and the sunlight, all of that. And I can only not only see, I can hear and smell and taste and touch. This is, I am the subject and I'm experiencing the object. What else appears to me? Before doing any Vedanta, just common sense. I, the subject, seem to be this body. It is instinctive. I am this body. And it seems to me this world of objects is continuously changing. I am sort of unchanging because I have been there since my childhood, as far as I remember, from babyhood. And I guess I will live for some more time. So although I am unchanging, see the paradox of it. Although I feel I am the same one, but I feel I am going to die. And this world is continuously changing, but I feel this will go on. It existed before me and it will continue to exist after me. Right? That's what we feel instinctively. I'm going to die. And not only that, I am dependent on this world of objects for everything. For my pleasure, for my entertainment, for my very sustenance. The world provides me with food without which I would die. The world provides me with air without which I would suffocate in a minute. The world provides me with shelter and with friends and with knowledge, with entertainment. When I'm bored, there is the TV or the internet. When I want to study, there are books. Everything that is good, worthwhile, and gives me happiness is provided by the world. Or at least, even if it's not provided, often it's withheld. And I am dependent on the world for all my happiness. True. On the other hand, the world also provides me with a lot of suffering. There is disease and pain which the world can inflict upon me. And there is physical pain, emotional pain inflicted by the behavior of other people. And what's going on in the world. All my suffering seems to be caused by the object. And all possibility of happiness and nice, pleasant, is the object. I'm dependent helplessly upon the object. And very soon I'll be crushed out of existence. Dead. This is what appears to me in experience. Now bring Vedanta into play. Vedanta introduces, the first thing it introduces is a simple observation. You are the subject, right?
Yes.
And you experience, right?
Yeah.
And what do you experience?
The object.
That's true. Notice that the subject and the object cannot be the same thing. Object is what you experience, and subject is you, the experiencer. Notice also, consciousness or awareness is always on the side of the subject. I, the subject, am conscious of what? Of the object and of also myself. So consciousness is on my side. You might say, why not? Why can't consciousness be on the object side? After all, there are so many conscious beings. But notice, when we look at the object, whatever we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, they are objects but not consciousness. I can see you, I can see your body, I can hear your voice, I can see your behavior. If I'm a telepath, I can look into your mind and see your thoughts also, or experience your thoughts, but I can never objectify your consciousness, your awareness. So the subject is that which experiences and is separate from the object. And the subject is also conscious. The object, consciousness is never object. It is always the subject. Now if we apply that, then we see something remarkable happening. The first result which emerges from it is, when we look at ourselves, the subject, we notice what seemed instinctive to us, that I am the subject. Where is the subject? Here. But then here, this body, am I not aware of the body? Yes, I am. And the principle is, whatever you are aware of is an object. And you are the subject, which is awareness. Or at least awareness is on your side. So if I'm aware of the body by definition must be an object, like this. This, like the clothes that I'm wearing, object. Then in this case, this body, it is an object. In fact, it's an object to all my senses. I can see it, I can touch it, I can smell it, taste it, even hear it, you know, the sounds of the heartbeat or your tummy rumbling. All my five senses objectify the body. The body, I begin to discover, is an object. Just like things out there, it's a thing. It's a remarkable thing. It's an extraordinary biological machine. But it's still a thing. And anything that is an object to consciousness, it cannot be the subject. Till now, I thought I, the subject, am this one. But I now realize this is the world of objects, and part of it is the body. And that's common sense. You don't need Vedanta for it. It's just a little bit of reflection shows, yes, just as this body is an object to my doctor, the doctor who prods it and probes it and scans it and tests it, it's an object. It's a biological living object. For me also, it's a biological living object. It may be the vehicle I'm embodied in right now, but still it's an object. And to me, the consciousness, quite palpably so. In that case, I am not literally the body. The body is there, I'm not denying it. I seem to be embodied in this body. I seem to be, you know, in close proximity with this body. It's there. But I am not literally it. Not only that, if I am this conscious subject, my experiences go on without the experience of the body. Let me repeat that. My experiences go on. For example, in dreams. When I fall asleep, the body is there on the bed and sleeping. I still continue to have experiences. My dreams, pleasant dreams, nightmares, all of that continues, and no part of that dream is the body sleeping on the bed. I've completely forgotten it. What am I saying? Our conscious experience as subjects can go on without reference to this physical body. That's all I'm saying. That also goes to reinforce the idea that I, as a conscious subject, am not literally the body. My conscious experiences can go on without experiencing the body. You might say, wait, just a minute, you're pulling a fast one. Because after all, you, the conscious being, this conscious subject, is being generated by the body. The body is the reality, and the body, the brain and the nervous system are generating you, the so-called subject consciousness, which is dreaming. So you actually don't exist apart from the body. You are not a separate reality apart from the body. You are just something that's an epiphenomenon, a product of the body, processes in the body. But that's not established at all. Forget Vedanta. Even in hard science, that's what's called the hard problem of consciousness. You have that right now, there is just simply no way of reducing our first person experience as subjects, as consciousness, to the processes in the brain. That's the whole issue, the hot topic in consciousness studies. So we will go with this. I am consciousness. I continue to exist in dreams also without reference to the body. So I cannot literally be the body. Even further, even our minds, they're also objects. Thoughts, feelings, emotions, ideas, memories, all of them I experience. If I experience them, then it's an object. I am the experiencing consciousness. This distinction between mind and consciousness, pretty much well understood in Buddhism, Sankhya, Yoga, Advaita, not understood in modern consciousness studies. Still, if you ask a person in consciousness studies, what is it that you're studying? They will give a vague answer like consciousness, mind, emotion, ideas, memories, perceptions, all of that together. But no. Now we have this analytic knife to distinguish between consciousness and the mental objects, thoughts, emotions, ideas. In fact, what we consider to be our personality. A person might say that, I really literally don't think I'm a bundle of flesh and blood, but I'm a person. I have a personal history, I have thoughts, feelings, emotions, ideas. This is who I am. But all those thoughts, feelings, emotions, ideas are also objects. Some of them were not there a little while ago. Some of them have come up in your awareness now. Some of them will fade away over years. So you continue. What is you that continues? It can't be a thought. Thoughts are, they come and go just like that. It can't be a memory. They arise and fade away. It can't be a bundle of memories also. You are that bare consciousness which continues through the arising and disappearing of thoughts and emotions and ideas. So I am not even the mind. The mind is there. The person is there. But I am the consciousness which is dressed in the mind, and dressed in the person, and dressed in the body. Vedanta gives a rather subtle, little bit of reasoning to prove this. It says that in deep sleep, as we go from dreams to deep sleep, do you still exist or not? Now one might say, I don't exist. In deep sleep, it's nothing. It's just, I'm not there. But then you'd be put in a very strange position of saying that if I don't exist in deep sleep, and I cannot deny that there is a phenomenon called deep sleep, then in that case, every time I wake up, I'm created anew. I pop out of existence when I fall asleep, and I pop into existence when I wake up. It's very strange. Yeah. Nobody will accept that. It's against common sense. It's against law. Law says that you, the one who went to sleep and the one who woke up, is one and the same person. Continue to exist. It's much better to say that, you know, there's some kind of sleep mode like computers have. So we went into a kind of hibernation, no activity, no experience of objects, but you existed. And if you are that consciousness, you existed. Advaita puts forward an interesting proposition. What happens in deep sleep, general anesthesia, coma, is that you continue to exist completely unaffected as this pure awareness, but no object is presented to you. It's like light in deep space. If you look at deep space, it looks dark. But it's full of light streaming from the sun. It's only when there's some object to reflect that light, suddenly you see something flashing and shining, like a comet racing through the solar system. You can see the brilliant display of the tail of the comet. But the comet doesn't come with its internal lighting. It's just light from the sun which is being reflected by the tail of the comet. And you see the brilliant display there. Similarly, if all objects are removed, there's nothing to see outside for because you're fallen asleep, you're not seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, not even aware of the body, not even dreaming, deep sleep, no physical objects, no mental objects, just blank, that's deep sleep. That doesn't mean consciousness is gone. So Advaita says, in deep sleep, it's not an absence of consciousness, it's a consciousness of absence. It's not that awareness is gone, but you are aware of only blankness and absence. What comes out when you wake up is just the appearance of these objects. So therefore, I am not even the mind, because I continue as consciousness when the mind is gone, in deep sleep, anesthesia, coma. So this one consciousness, which experiences through the mind and body, the physical body and the external objects, through the mind, dream objects, mental objects, and when mind and body are not appearing, just the absence of the mind and body, this one continuous consciousness, can it die? So what changes and dies? Objects, all the time, by our own experience. But consciousness itself, can it die? If it was generated by the brain, it could die, because the brain will die after some time, in the death of the body. But if you say it cannot be generated by the brain, heart problem, you know, care of the heart problem of consciousness, how will it die? It requires change. But consciousness itself is unchanging. You say, are we supposed to believe that? Consciousness seems to be changing all the time. And early in the morning, I'm a little sleepy, and then I have a cup of coffee, and then I'm more conscious. Well, Vedanta would say what was sleepy was the mind, and what became more sharp and alert is the mind after a cup of coffee. Not consciousness itself. Consciousness revealed you as the sleepy mind. Consciousness revealed the alert mind. Consciousness was not sleepy or alert. It was shining, self-same shining consciousness. This is a logical reason why I'm saying that consciousness cannot change. Why? If it changes, and you can speak about it, you can describe it, anything that you can speak about, describe, observe is an object to consciousness. Then the change must be in the object, not in consciousness. If it was in consciousness, it could not be objectified. But one might say that, all right, let consciousness change, but we cannot see it, we cannot experience it, then why talk of it at all? That which can never be known, why postulate it? So there is this reasoning which shows that consciousness logically cannot change. Pure consciousness, bare awareness, cannot change. Change is that which appears to consciousness. The object changes, the limited things changes. The world of objects continuously changes. That's why we have the intuitive feeling. Even when we are not doing Vedanta, we have this intuitive feeling, I am the same one. From babyhood to teenage to middle age to old age, somehow I am the same one. You have this intuitive feeling. If its consciousness cannot change, how can it die? How can it die? In Vedanta, consciousness is said to be unborn and undying. If I am unborn and undying, I have no fear of death. I, the consciousness, have no fear of death. Remember what we felt like earlier? I am entirely dependent on the world for all the goodies, and I'm scared of the world for all the baddies which come from the world. Now this one consciousness, think of this consciousness, do a mental experiment now, without reference to the world. You're not seeing anything, hearing anything, smelling, tasting, touching anything. You're not aware of the body, imagine in deep sleep. You're not thinking anything. You're not remembering anything. Suppose all memories of your personality have been erased. You've left it aside. No awareness of the external world. No memories, no thoughts, no sense of I even. Just the bare awareness. This bare awareness, what does it want? What does it want? As you're saying, nothing. Are you with me, some of you? You're following? It wants nothing. Because wanting comes with the activity of the mind. Right? What does it or whom does it hate? Nothing. What does it expect? What is its guilt, sorrow, regret? Nothing. That comes with the activity of the mind. What is it waiting for? What God to appear? What samadhi to be attained? What enlightenment event? What is it waiting for? Nothing. It is deathless. It is beyond desire. It is beyond suffering. Beyond wanting. It is timeless. Because time becomes obvious only when the mind starts working. Space becomes obvious only when the senses start working. See, even when Advaita Vedanta says Brahman is all-pervading, this is already accepting space. You have accepted space, then you say it's all-pervading. When Brahman is eternal, and Buddhists have a great objection to that, that something is eternal. But that's only after you have accepted time. Then you find the division between all objects are changing continuously, so Brahman must be eternal. But even time and space are appearances in consciousness, thanks to the mind. This one consciousness, it is deathless, it's birthless, it is complete in itself, it does not want anything at all. Does it want enlightenment, this consciousness itself? No. Some of you are not confident. If you think about it, just your thought experiment, you'll say, no, if it's something like that is there, it will not want enlightenment. And if I am that, I don't want enlightenment. And this one consciousness, someone might say, yes, but that's a very kind of abstract thing. No world, no body, no mind, and then there's some bare awareness. It's not our usual worldly experience. But wait a minute. Right now, what you call the usual worldly experience, is that awareness there, here, now? Think about it this way. Are you aware right now? You'll all say, yeah, we are aware. We are seeing you. How do you know? We are having experiences. We are seeing you. All right, close your eyes. You're not seeing me anymore. You're not seeing anything anymore. Are you still aware? What do you think? I can't hear, see your response. You have to say yes. Yes. I'm still aware. And similarly, if I plug my ears, you know, in a sensory deprivation tank, I don't see anything, hear, smell, taste, touch, anything. Would I still be aware? Yeah, I'd still be aware. I'd be thinking, when is this going to end? And if I stop thinking there, no thoughts, no memories, no ideas, no desires, would I still be there? Would that awareness would be there? Logically, yes, because those are objects. If I drop them, why would the subject disappear? But it's not experiencing anything, but it's still awareness is there. Even if I drop the sense of I, the awareness, just drop that also, the awareness would still continue. And that awareness, which is there in the absence of world, body, mind, is also there right now. In fact, if you don't see, you still exist as awareness. If you don't think, you still exist as awareness. But suppose, just thought experiment, suppose that awareness itself were not there. Would you be able to see the experience of seeing? That consciousness, that awareness, if it were not there, be bold. Just think, look at your experience. I, the awareness shining, I'm aware of thoughts. Through the thoughts, I'm aware of the body-mind. Through the body-mind, I'm aware of this external world. If I, the awareness, were not there, would this experience of seeing be possible? No. Would the experience of hearing, smelling, tasting, touching be possible? No. Would the experience of thinking, experience of the spiritual quest, would any experience be possible if I, the awareness, were not there? No. So this awareness, because of this, we are constantly having all these experiences. And forgetting the nature of this awareness, we are only using it for all these experiences. We are using a diamond to scrub dirty laundry. We are using it for seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting. We are using it for ambition and greed and fighting and hating. We are using it for suffering. And we are using it for a spiritual quest to take us beyond suffering. But this awareness in itself is beyond suffering already. Even in the midst of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, it's beyond suffering. What suffers? This awareness forgetting its real nature? In alliance with the mind and the senses and one body becomes a suffering living being, sentient being. The awareness recognizing its own nature with the help of the mind. How do you recognize? With the help of the mind. Recognizing its own nature in the midst of hearing, smelling, tasting, talking, living, you know, doing whatever has to be done in life is free of suffering. If I identify myself, if I note that I am that bare awareness, no matter what happens, I'm actually free of suffering, in the midst of suffering also. Sri Ramakrishna, an example, famous example, dying of throat cancer. And his disciple, Hari, Swami Turiyananda, comes, young boy, comes at the and says, how are you today, sir? And Sri Ramakrishna says, oh, it hurts, I cannot eat. And this young man, for some reason, says to him, but sir, I see that you're in great delight. Apni anande achin. The cruel thing to say to a cancer patient. Sri Ramakrishna bursts out laughing and says, oh, the rascal has found me out. He admits that this boy is right. I'm in great bliss. Now, was he acting that he is in pain and he cannot eat? Is it his play acting? No, it's true. Just like any cancer patient suffers, he suffered. But like most cancer patients do not have this insight, which in the midst of suffering, gives him this oasis of peace. That I am in my real nature as awareness, which is not an object, which illumines all objects, including this painful object of a cancer and a tumor and a dying body. I am all right. I was before this appearance of this cancerous tumor, and I'll be there after this cancerous tumor disappears and the body disappears. I'm in the middle of that also. In the middle of this appearance also, I'm fine. And it's not just Sri Ramakrishna. All of us, we have that diamond right now, which takes us beyond suffering, which is itself beyond suffering, which makes possible, however, the experience of suffering. If that awareness were not there, would you experience suffering? No. You would not experience anything. So experience of pleasure, experience of pain, experience of bondage, experience of liberation, all of them, samsara and liberation, moksha, appear and disappear in that same field of awareness. And that awareness you are. You say, oh, this is great. Advaita Vedanta, wonderful. What I just quoted now is literally a line from Mahayana Buddhism. Samsara and Nirvana, both are phenomena appearing in that limitless and clear light of the void. You see? How it seems to come together. One more step is necessary. So right now it seems I have isolated myself as pure awareness. I investigated the subject, the seer, the experiencer in Sanskrit, drashta. And I've separated myself from the drishya, this world. I am the subject, pure awareness. The world appears to me. And I am just this awareness, bare awareness. But then one might ask, first, what is this world then? What is its relationship to you, the awareness? And how is this non-duality? This seems like complete duality. Awareness and a world of objects. Right? That's what we have achieved so far. No non-duality so far. This is Sankhya philosophy, a Sankhya dualism. The world of objects and this awareness. Now, Advaita Vedanta comes and says, Tattvam asi, the reality which appears as this world of objects and the reality, this awareness which you are, they're one and the same reality. That which appears as this universe is called Brahman. That which appears as you, this awareness, is called Atman. And Advaita Vedanta says, Atman is Brahman. That's the conclusion. You are that. Atman is Brahman. In that book, Jim Holt's book, Why Does the World Exist? This is not an inquiry into oneself. It's an inquiry into this universe. And there he goes around asking, philosophers, nuclear physicists, cosmologists like Roger Penrose, mathematicians, computer scientists, people of religion, theologians, why does this world exist? And towards the end of that book, he asks a famous American philosopher who passed recently, Robert Nozick. And he asks the same question. And after some discussion, the philosopher seems to sort of metaphorically throw up his hands and says, who knows, maybe the Hindus are right, Atman is Brahman. So Advaita Vedanta comes in and says, no, that material reality is not apart from you. Because Atman is Brahman, what you found as that bare awareness, yourself as this limitless awareness, and what it is experiencing as this world of objects, whose reality is Brahman, they are not two. Atman is Brahman. Sam Altman, ChatGPT, he also said that. Atman. Somebody asked him that, tell us something that you believe which most people don't know or don't believe. And he said, Atman is Brahman. How does that solve our problem, establish non-duality? Here is it. As one great master said in Hindi, he said, ये तो ठीक है कि दृष्टा दृश्य से अलग है, लेकिन कभी सोचा है दृश्य क्या दृष्टा से अलग है? What does it mean? It is true. Consciousness is distinct and apart from all the objects. You are awareness, distinct and apart from all this world of objects, changing objects, including body and mind. But have you ever thought, consider this thought, is this world of objects, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, physical body, mind, is this world of objects distinct from you? You are distinct from all of this, but is it distinct from you? What does it mean? See, when usually two things are distinct, one thing is distinct from the other, the second one must be distinct from the first. So, for example, this microphone is distinct from this cloth. So cloth is also distinct from the microphone. They are two separate things. How do you know? One good way of saying is, can you experience one in the absence of the other? Can you experience the microphone in absence of the cloth? Yes. Can you experience the cloth in absence of the microphone? Yes. So they are separate things. But if there's something that you cannot experience in the absence of the other, you begin to think they may not be two distinct things. They seem different, but if one cannot be experienced without the other, then there must be some connection somewhere. So what? Now think about it. Objects appear to you in consciousness. You experience objects in consciousness. Consciousness can exist by itself, can appear, but it can continue in the absence of objects like deep sleep, like coma, like samadhi. Consciousness can continue. But can objects be ever experienced without consciousness? What is the principle? Two things are separate if they can be experienced separately. Now I'm asking, can objects be experienced without consciousness? It's a trick question. The moment you say experienced, you're already building consciousness into that question. What is experience? Consciousness plus object. That's what we decided earlier. Objects can never be experienced in the absence of consciousness. In fact, the absence of consciousness, according to Advaita Vedanta, is an impossibility. Objects always appear to consciousness in consciousness. And then Advaita Vedanta makes this remarkable claim: if objects cannot be experienced in the absence of consciousness, then the objects cannot be different from consciousness. Somehow, it must be consciousness itself experiencing itself as objects. As one monk put it, what's the nature of the eye? The nature of the eyes is to see. But when a little kid looks up into the sky, it's just empty space. There is no surface to be seen. He imagines, it seems to him, like an inverted blue bowl, like a surface which he's seeing. The eyes want to see. There's no space to be seen. And so it looks like a surface. There's no surface to be seen. This empty space looks like a surface. He gives that example and says, consciousness alone exists according to Advaita Vedanta. The nature of consciousness is to experience. Look at our own experience of life. Nature of consciousness is to experience. There's nothing else except consciousness to experience. And consciousness cannot be experienced as an object. So the great conclusion is, these objects, so-called objects, are nothing but consciousness itself appearing to itself in that form. That you must give credit consciousness as an innate ability of consciousness, what the Buddhists call a magical display of the phenomena of samsara and nirvana. When in samsara, struggling through spiritual life, you recognize the nature of reality as this limitless awareness, then the same samsara now appears to you as nirvana. Nagarjuna, 2,000 years ago, he said there is no distinction between samsara and nirvana. That sounds stunning, because the entire project of Buddhism is to go from samsara to nirvana. Now you're saying there's no distinction, but don't misunderstand. It does not mean that the spiritual project is wrong. In fact, that's the only project that's worthwhile. But it ultimately, you will see, that which presents samsara to you, this world of objects, that when it's truly recognized, this very world of objects will, samsara will seem like nirvana, will be nirvana to you. Freedom. Because that consciousness, it neither requires samsara nor requires nirvana. It's always free. That's why Shankaracharya sings, mano buddhi hankara chittani naham, chidananda rupa shivoham. Then he says, na dharmo, na chartho, na kamo, na moksha. I don't even want moksha, nirvana. Why? Chidananda rupa shivoham shivoham. Because I'm of the nature of consciousness and bliss. I am Shiva. I am Shiva. That's why the consciousness itself does not want moksha. It's the sentient being who feels that I am caught in samsara. Moksha is not here as yet. I must struggle for moksha and nirvana. And then attains to nirvana by realizing who am I, what am I. And then sees this entire display as appearing in that consciousness, as nothing but that consciousness, then everything that we experience in this world, people, trees and, you know, animals, sky and earth and water and fire, all of that, and our internal universe of thoughts and emotions and ideas, good and bad, all of that is nothing but this one consciousness, filling it through and through, Purnam. Everything that we encounter is this one limitless awareness. Our own nature, called Atman, Brahman. The Buddhists called it the clear light of the void. And this is appearing to us in all of these forms. And therefore, Purnamadah Purnamidam, that transcendent light is this world of subject and object. Right now, in our own experience. From that transcendent light, this world, Purnasya Purnam, Purnat Purnamudachyate, from that fullness, this has arisen. What does it mean? In you, that limitless awareness, this world of objects, mind, body, and external world has arisen. Purnasya Purnamadaya, in this fullness, if you recognize all these objects are nothing but me, the pure light, Purnameva Vashishyate, light alone exists then. This limitless light alone exists. Now, I don't want to overburden, overuse this light metaphor because it can be misunderstood, grossly misunderstood. Somebody said to me that, okay, so we are all this light. So light is photons. Are we photons? I said, oh God, no, not in that sense. It's a metaphor. I don't mean that we're actually physical light there. It's just bare awareness. That's what's compared to light. Because of the nature, it illumines everything and is self-revealing. This light illumines physical things and is self-revealing. In that sense, consciousness or awareness illumines everything and is self-revealing. Purnamadah Purnamidam. What seems very far away, diamond. And it seems very different. This is a rock. Same thing. And it seems that from the rock a diamond has come. But it didn't, because the rock and the diamond were the same. When does it seem? After realizing that it's a diamond. Oh, from the rock a diamond has arisen. It hasn't actually arisen, it was always that. Then, Purnasya Purnamadaya, in the rock when you discover the diamond, Purnameva Vashishyate, the diamond alone remains. So this is a very profound subject. And I just want to leave us with this thought that in the end, if you have attended last week's talk, at the five schools, progressively deeper understanding of, none of them are wrong understandings, they are deeper and deeper understandings of the teaching of emptiness. The last one, emptiness as the clear light of the void in which samsara and nirvana are appearing and disappearing. Doesn't it sound remarkably similar to what the goal we have reached right now? I know there are serious objections on both sides. I have had Buddhist masters saying, no, you can't conflate this with the Hindu Advaita view. That's wrong, that's an eternalism. There's one eternal reality called Brahman you're talking about. Not really, as we saw. It's eternal only accepting time as a reality. But and on the Hindu side, they say, no, you can't conflate Purnam and Shunyam, because Shunyam is just nothing, it's nihilism, which is again unfair, because Nagarjuna 2000 years ago strongly says we are not talking about nothing. Does it exist? We say no. Does it not exist? We say no. Both exist and not exist? We say no. Neither exist nor does not exist? We say no. Chatushkoti Vinirmukta Tattvam, the reality is beyond these four logical alternatives of the mind. The mind keeps playing within these logical alternatives. The truth is beyond all these concepts. I got a call from a great traditional teacher of Vedanta from India, from Banaras, in alarm, saying, are you going to, in Bengali, he said, Shunno Purno Ek Kore Deben Naki? Will you make it one? What's going to happen in this talk? Are you going to say that Shunyam and Purnam are... in one sense, in a sort of ultimate sense, yes. Swami Saradanandaji, the biographer of Sri Ramakrishna, in Sri Ramakrishna, the great master, he writes, what they, the Buddhists, call Shunyam, it is what we call Purnam. We're talking about the same thing itself. Sri Ramakrishna, I'll let him have the last word. Very interesting last word. very Purnam type teacher, you know, who said in every path, whether you're worshiping God as mother like he did, or as the beloved Krishna, or as the Christ of the Christians, or as Allah of the Muslims, in whichever way you do, it is the same reality. You can see the Purnam philosophy behind it. Once he was asked about the Buddha and emptiness. It's in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Somebody said to him, but the Buddha was a Nastic. A Nastic might mean two things. One is a non-believer in the Vedas, which he was. And the other one is not believing in some God or ultimate reality, which he was not. Sri Ramakrishna immediately protested and said, why should he be a Nastic? He could not express in language what he had discovered. He could not put it in language. Why could he not put it in language? Was his Sanskrit grammar faulty? No, he was a very learned person, a very learned prince. He had gone through all the philosophies, and after giving up his kingdom and searching for, you know, enlightenment, he had gone to all the existing masters and learned whatever they had to teach. So he knew all that. But what he had discovered finally could not be put in language. The moment you have language, you have concepts. Language and concepts come together. And you try to put in that, you will be doing an injustice. So Sri Ramakrishna said, but he didn't explain all this. He just said he could not put in language what he had discovered. And I'm just reminded, you know, the Buddha's great silence when he was asked these questions. I think 14 questions, he remained silent. There's a lot of discussion in Buddhist philosophy, why did he remain silent? Not because he didn't know the answers. He knew all the answers, but none of them were adequate. Why did he remain silent? Because the real answer cannot be put in language. And that's the beginning of the Madhyamaka philosophy of Nagarjuna, who says if you clothe it in language and concepts, it's bound to be wrong. And then comes the extraordinary statement of Sri Ramakrishna. He says, Osti nastir majhe sheikhane thik thik, in Bengali. That which is between is and is not. That's exactly right. Which is a very strange statement for a Hindu teacher to make. The Hindu teacher, beyond existence and non-existence, beyond the manifest and non-manifest, is Brahman. That language you find in the Upanishads, in the Gita, nasat nasad uchyate, Bhagavad Gita, you find that language. But between, this between is a very peculiarly Buddhist idiom. In fact, the very word madhyamaka means between. It's neither the extreme of some existing God, Atman, Brahman, nor the extreme of nothingness. It's between. Madhyamaka. Literally, in anybody who knows Indian languages, it sounds immediately like middle. Madhyamaka. And here Sri Ramakrishna says, that's exactly right. This most Hindu of all teachers, this image worshipper, worshipper of Kali, this Purnam teacher, and he uses the word of the language of Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and says, that's exactly right. All right, we take it as it is. It's an amazing journey into emptiness last week and into fullness this week. I pray to Sri Ramakrishna, Ma Sharada, Swami Vivekananda to bless us with that vision, with that insight which liberates us from samsara, where we can finally see samsara and nirvana or moksha as appearances in the reality that we are, this limitless awareness. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Shri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. Thank you very much.